It certainly is a very exciting time in the field of dermatologic aesthetic surgery, with many new innovative treatments for the aging face. In this dialogue, Dr. Hema Sundaram and Dr. Lauren Council lead us through these groundbreaking advances and provide us with an overview of soft tissue augmentation.
Hello, and welcome to Dialogues in Dermatology. I'm Lauren Council in practice at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and I'm speaking today with Dr. Hema Sundaram in private practice in Rockville, Maryland and Fairfax, Virginia. Very fortunate to have you here today, Hema. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Lauren.
So we're going to be talking today about soft tissue augmentation. And Dr. Sundaram, in the past 10 years, we've experienced somewhat of an explosion in the types of fillers that are available to dermatologists. Could you please elaborate for our listeners maybe some of the history and the evolution of fillers in the United States?
Absolutely, Lauren. In fact, the history of soft tissue augmentation goes back even to the times of the ancient Greeks and Romans. But in modern times, we have certain landmarks. Firstly, the approval of collagen by the US FDA for cosmetic use, which was in 1981. And at that point, we had a safe, reliable, predictable filler that could be used for right. It was a wrinkle-filling agent. It was relatively short-acting, maybe from, 6 to 12 or 16 weeks typically, shorter acting than some of the fillers that we've subsequently had available to us. But there's no doubt that it ushered in a new era in terms of what we could do for non-surgical rejuvenation. In 2003, we had the first hyaluronic acid filler approved. This was Restylane. And since then, we've had other hyaluronic acids approved, the Juvederm family, and most recently, Bellaterra. The difference between hyaluronic acid and collagen maybe we'll discuss a little bit later on, but as we go through our history, we then had polyol-lactic acid Sculptra, which is classified as a semi-permanent filler, initially approved for correction of HIV-associated lipoatrophy in 2004, and in 2009 it was approved for aesthetic use. We had polymethyl methacrylate, or Artifil, which is a permanent filler, approved in 2006. And we also had Radiesse calcium hydroxylapatite, approved in 2006. Amongst the other hyaluronic acids, we have also Perlane, which is within the Restylane family. That was approved in 2007. We mentioned already Juvederm Ultra and Ultra Plus. There is a low concentration product, Prevail Silk, which will most likely not be available after the end of 2014, but that came to us in 2008. And our most recent hyaluronic acid approval was Juvederm Voluma XC in 2013.
So you've mentioned a lot of different types of fillers for our listeners. If you had to broadly classify those, it sounds like they could be considered hyaluronic acid fillers and non-hyaluronic acid fillers. What's the main difference between those two broad categories?
Lauren, I think that's a good way to look at it in overview. Hyaluronic acid fillers are polysaccharide-based, and they are cross-linked for longevity, and they produce immediate results, so that when we inject them, we're straight away going to see improvement. To some extent or other, all of them are water-binding, and that means that we will get some swelling after injection. That means that we want to, in general, avoid overcorrection with these products. They are reversible through the injection of hyaluronidase to enzymatically digest them.
Well, are there differences between the various hyaluronic acid fillers, or what makes each one slightly different?
Well, each of these fillers is scientifically engineered in a different way, Lauren. And now with increasing transparency from the filler manufacturers, we can see that there is a definite drive towards engineering certain characteristics in fillers with the aim of achieving specific clinical outcomes. So one of the things we can look at is suitability for implantation at various depths. And we have the more volumizing fillers, which tend to be a little firmer and to have more of a supportive or lifting effect, and they can be injected more deeply in the periosteal or the subcutaneous plane. And fillers that would fall into that category include Restylane, Perlane, Juvederm Voluma, Ultra and Ultra Plus. Hyaluronic acid fillers that would fall into that category of being deeper injected would be for us in the U.S., Juvederm Ultra and Ultra Plus and Juvederm Voluma, Restylane and Perlane. Those ones are going to be placed in the periosteal and subcutaneous planes. We have now one hyaluronic acid in this country which is engineered for superficial injection and is a high concentration HA. That is Bellaterra Balance. And that is a softer, more flowing filler. It's not going to provide as much tissue support, but it's going to be able to be injected at a higher level, even into the dermis. So we can use that for filling of fine lines and for sheeting in order to provide a more superficial type of volumetry. Preval Silk is also designed for superficial injection, but it is a lower concentration and has a lesser longevity. We can look then at the non-hyaluronic acid fillers. They may have immediate effects. Radies does, that is calcium hydroxyl apatite, and it also has a more long-term effect based on collagenesis. Another non-hyaluronic acid filler we have is polylactic acid or Sculptra. That will produce a transient effect immediately after injection, but that will dissipate. And the long-term volumizing effects will develop over a period of weeks to months due to stimulation of collagenesis. And the same is true for polymethyl methacrylate Artifil. That will have some immediate corrective effect because it has spheres suspended in collagen, and the collagen will provide that temporary effect. However, the long-term permanent effect is due to stimulation of collagen. So although the non-HAs have been thought of as biostimulatory and HAs have not been described in that manner, what we're understanding now is that hyaluronic acids also have the potential to stimulate collagenesis, to mediate signaling pathways. The non-hyaluronic acids are non-reversible. In general, they tend not to bind water. That has some implications in terms of how we inject them. We're injecting to complete correction for them, whereas we may sometimes undercorrect with the hyaluronic acid in order.
Do all of these fillers have the same Food and Drug Administration approved uses?
The first FDA approved use for these fillers was for temporary improvement of moderate to severe folds such as the nasolabial folds. Hyaluronic acid fillers are approved for temporary reduction in the appearance of nasolabial folds. One of the hyaluronic acids, Restylane, has an additional approval for augmentation of the lips. The other hyaluronic acid products, if used for this indication, are being used off-label. Our newest hyaluronic acid, Juvederm Voluma, has a different indication. This is for mid-face volumization. Sculptra and Radies were initially approved for restoration of. Sculptra and Radies were initially approved for facial lipoatrophy in patients with HIV. They both now have an aesthetic approval as well for volumization purposes. Again, the specification is for temporary reduction in moderate to severe folds, such as nasolabial folds.
You mentioned that use of some of the hyaluronic acid fillers other than Restylane for lip augmentation is considered an off-label use. What are some of the other more commonly used off-label indications for these products?
Some of the off-label uses that we see commonly with soft tissue fillers are for the jowls and the pre-jowl sulcus, for the lower eyelid, including the tear troughs, and also the periocular region in general. We're now understanding that it's important to volumize the temporal fossae and even the forehead as well in order to adopt a holistic panfacial approach. Off the face, fillers can be used for the dorsum of the hands. They can be very effective for ameliorating the bony veined appearance that hands get with time due to loss of volume. And we can also look at use in the décolleté region and potentially even for augmentation of the buttock region. And there are also reports of use of soft tissue fillers for injection into the feet so that this can relieve pressure points when high-heeled shoes are worn. So essentially, we've expanded our applications of hyaluronic fillers panfacially in order to achieve an integrative approach and recontour the face rather than just filling lines, and we've now gone beyond that to off-the-face indications.
Another off-label use that we hear about is the addition of lidocaine or saline to a filler. Why do some practitioners do this?
There are two reasons, Lauren, to add lidocaine to a filler. The original reason was for fillers that did not already have integrated lidocaine to reduce discomfort during the procedure. So a small volume of lidocaine suspension could be mixed with the filler just prior to injection. And the paradigm for this is calcium hydroxyl apatite or Radies, which actually has an FDA approval for a mixing protocol that results in a final lidocaine concentration of 0.3%. What was serendipitously found from these mixing protocols was that there was a modification of the physicochemical structures of the fillers. There was a decrease in viscosity and also in the G prime or the elasticity of the fillers. That meant that the fillers were a little bit more spreadable and that they were a little less firm. And this was found to be useful for tailoring the fillers to specific clinical applications. So these days, some practitioners are adding lidocaine or saline or a mixture of lidocaine and saline to fillers even when they already have integrated lidocaine in order to modify their properties and make them more suitable, for instance, for superficial injection where we want a softer, more spreading filler, or for volumization of areas where we don't want palpability of the filler after injection.
Very interesting. With so many products that are available today, how does one choose which product to address the patient concerns and optimize their outcomes?
Well, Lauren, I think it's important to start with the patient consultation and understand what the patient's desires and expectations are. But it's very important for us as practitioners to filter the patient's comments to us through the prism of our understanding. Patients, for instance, may ask for augmentation of the lips, but we will understand that what they need is volumization of the perioral fat compartments. Patients may ask for a toxin to the forehead, and we may understand that actually the changes they are seeing are due to volume loss and they would be better served with a filler to that region. So when we are looking at what products to choose, I will start by saying that there are some areas where I consider hyaluronic acids. This is my personal practice and my personal philosophy where I consider only hyaluronic acids suitable for use. One of those areas is the lips. I think that would be generally agreed upon that we would use hyaluronic acid fillers for augmentation there. The other region where I use only hyaluronic acid fillers is the periocular region. It's an anatomically unforgiving area. There are some safety concerns there as well. And the advantage of hyaluronic acids is that they are completely reversible if needed. For the other areas of the face in terms of product selection, in the mid-face and the lower face, we may choose a hyaluronic acid or a non-hyaluronic acid. In the forehead, I also prefer to use a hyaluronic acid filler alone. In the temples, we can use either a hyaluronic acid or non-hyaluronic acid. Now, within those categories, we have different options. For instance, as we've discussed, we have several different hyaluronic acids. So what I look at when I'm choosing a specific product is the balance of the different scientific properties and which of those properties can be tangibly linked to clinical outcomes. So within the tissue, we've talked a lot in the past about tissue lift and linked that to elasticity or G prime. What I think we really need to understand now is that from studies of the aging face, we now comprehend that this is a deflation process in three dimensions. The aging face loses support structure due to deflation and descent of the fat compartments, due to bone resorption and changes even in the more superficial tissues of the dermis and the epidermis. Because volume loss is multi-level, we can think in terms of restoring volume with fillers in a multi-level manner. Because we need to restore in that multi-level manner, perhaps we need to move away from thinking about lift, which is a bolus phenomenon where we are injecting a filler deep down, pre-periosteal or in a deep subcutis, and we are elevating the tissues. And we need to think more about supporting tissues in three dimensions, which implies a multi-level process. So when we adopt that philosophy, we can look at the balance of tissue support, which would be determined by elasticity or G prime, and to some extent also cohesivity, how well the product stays together with itself, and also water binding. And then we're going to balance that with spreading, which is determined by primarily, and we're going to balance that with the spreadability of the filler, which is primarily determined by viscosity. So we have now two things that we are looking at, that is tissue support, how well the product spreads, as opposed to, with a high viscosity product, what we call contour stability, how well it stays put where it is placed. Some other things that we can look at are moldability, which we consider to be primarily determined by plasticity of the filler. But we also have to look at cohesivity, because a product that has a very high cohesivity is going to want to stick to itself rather than being molded or being spread out in the tissue. These are the properties of the fillers themselves, but we have to integrate that with the properties of the tissues into which we're implanting, for instance, the tissue quality. And we also have to integrate the injection techniques that we're going to be using. Are we going to be injecting a large bolus, or are we going to be dispersing with a cannula? So, for instance, we can take the example of the lips and say that if we want to have a soft, so-called pillow lip look, we may go with a product that is less firm, a product that has a lower elasticity and a higher viscosity. So, for example, if we're looking at the lips and we want to achieve the so-called pillow-lipped look, we want to augment and have a soft look to the lips, we may go with a product that has a low elasticity and a low viscosity, because that's going to be softer and it's going to spread out more. And examples of that type of product are the Juvederm Ultra and Ultra Plus products and Bellaterra. But if we want to have more of a shaping type of effect, or to have a contour stability, such as along the Vermilion border, we may go with a higher elasticity, higher viscosity product such as Restylane. That's looking at the lips. If we look at other areas of the face, in the mid-face we can balance the need for tissue support versus whether we want the product to be palpable in tissue. Some patients really don't desire that. And again, we need to look not only at elasticity, but at the water binding capacity and the cohesivity of the product. So we could choose a high support product like Radies, or Perlane or Restylane. Those products will be firm and relatively palpable in tissue, and we're going to place them deep down. Or we could choose products that are somewhat softer but bind some water and are going to provide tissue support through a combination of elasticity and water binding, such as the Juvederm products and now Juvederm Voluma. Bellaterra, which is a very soft flowing product, we would tend to be using more for very superficial implantation, as for fine lines or for sheeting to restore elasticity, to restore tissue turgor to the uppermost layers. Polyl-lactic acid or Sculptra can be used also for volumizing the midface. This is not going to give an immediate effect, but it will ultimately have the effects, once collagenesis is stimulated, of a high supporting product. If we look then at other areas such as the tear trough or the lower eyelid, this is, as I said, an anatomically unforgiving area. Typically, we've tended to place products underneath the orbicularis oculi muscle. That is a plane in which we can place even a high G-prime product such as Restylane, and we can not have palpability or contour irregularity after injection. There is a trend these days towards diluting a higher G-prime product like Restylane and injecting it into that area. That enables us to have a little bit more of a forgiving product and to really avoid that contour instability and also Tyndall effect, which we'll discuss a little later. I don't tend to use the Juvederm products very much around the eyes because in my experience they tend to swell a little bit more, they bind a bit more water. There are some newer Juvederm family products coming to us ultimately, which are now approved in Europe, that are designed for use in the lower eyelid region and the periocular region in general. We can also use Bellaterra Balance, which is a softer, more flowing product, and that can be injected not only below the muscle, but also above the muscle into the intradermal and immediate subdermal planes if we want to achieve, again, a multi-level volume restoration. And those products that are either diluted or are already designed for more superficial injection are going to have a reduced risk of Tyndall effect when injected superficially, even into the thin-skinned areas such as the lower eyelid.
So it sounds like different fillers are ideal for different areas or different techniques of injection. You mentioned or briefly touched on the importance of using a hyaluronic acid filler in certain locations because of its reversibility. And there are several areas in the face which could be considered danger zones or areas where one should be very careful when injecting. Could you briefly elaborate on what areas on the face an injector must be the most cautious?
Yes, absolutely, Lauren. You know, the first thing I would say is that we have to potentially consider every area of the face that we're injecting to be a danger zone, in the sense that we have to have a thorough understanding of anatomy and safety considerations before we start treating any patient. We also have to be aware of the fact that patients don't read the textbooks. You know, patients can have so-called aberrant vasculature, aberrant distribution of neurovascular structures. So we cannot assume that a particular structure is going to be where we consider it to be. But if we work down the face, you know, the upper face is an area that we do consider to be of concern from a safety perspective. The glabella is probably, in my mind, the area where we have to be most concerned about safety. There are the most anastomoses from there into the internal vasculature, you know, the internal carotid artery branches. So in this region, we have to be very careful. What can we do to optimize safety in this area? Well, again, I like to use only a hyaluronic acid in that area because it's reversible. There are some emergency measures we can take if we have indication that there is ischemia or early impending compromise of the vasculature.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Lauren.
The use of fillers for aesthetic soft tissue augmentation has evolved greatly over the past 30 years since the FDA approval of collagen. As a filler, collagen was short-lived, carried a potential risk for immediate and delayed hypersensitivity, and was used to, quote, fill a line, end quote. The treatment paradigm for soft tissue augmentation with fillers has shifted from this line-filling technique to that of panfacial volume restoration. This technique involves critically evaluating the intrinsic and extrinsic processes of aging and noting how they affect fat pad resorption and redistribution, skeletal remodeling, and static and dynamic rigidities formation. Evaluating a patient with this holistic approach allows one to address the different components of aging and provide a panfacial volumetric treatment plan. Prior to embarking on soft tissue augmentation with fillers, one must be critically aware of the intrinsic properties of the fillers being used and the anatomy of the areas to be treated. Broadly, soft tissue fillers can be divided into temporary and semi-permanent fillers or hyaluronic HA acid and non-HA based fillers. In this dialogue, the on and off label uses of HA fillers and non-HA fillers are reviewed in addition to a review of the facial, quote, danger zones, end quote, of filler use. Recent advances in the world of HA fillers has resulted in the approval of two novel fillers, Juvederm Voluma XC and Bellatero Balance. Voluma is the only FDA-approved filler for midfacial volume restoration and is formulated from a mixture of low and high molecular weight HA. Pivotal studies indicate that volume correction with Voluma lasts up to 24 months, distinctly longer than other HA fillers. Conversely, Bellatero Balance is a distinct HA filler which undergoes a two-step cross-linking process that allows the product to distribute homogeneously into the dermis as a monophasic, polydensified, cohesive gel. It is thus indicated for correction of moderate to severe facial wrinkles and can be placed superficially in the dermis without the Tyndall effect. One advantage of using HA fillers is that they are revisable with the use of hyaluronidase. This is a critical intervention in the case of unwanted product migration, vascular compromise or occlusion, and/or nodule formation. It is important to query patients on bee venom allergy, as in most cases there can be cross-reactivity and resulting reaction to hyaluronidase. Major sequela, such as blindness and necrosis, have been reported with dermal filler usage. It is critical to be aware and exercise extreme caution in the areas of the named facial arteries, including the angular, supertrochlear, and superorbital and infraorbital arteries. Particular caution must be exercised if one attempts to fill the glabella and the nasolabial folds, as these are two particular, quote, danger zones, end quote. One must also remember that patients do not read the textbooks and the notable variations in the pattern of facial vascular arborization. An urgent management protocol including early retrobulbar injection of large amounts of hyaluronidase is the proposed localized treatment of choice for iatrogenic embolic blindness.